Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. Today, we will discuss a review article titled "The Superoxide Radical Switch in the Biology of Nitric Oxide and Peroxynitrite" that was published in the October 2022 issue of the journal. Joining us are Professor Giovanni Mann, an associate editor of the journal, and senior author Professor Raphael Roddy. Professor Mann, over to you.
Welcome to this Physiological Reviews podcast. My name is Giovanni Mann. I'm an associate editor of Physiological Reviews, and today I have the personal great pleasure of hosting Professor Raphael Roddy, who has contributed significantly to our understanding of the mechanisms of nitric oxide-dependent toxicity through its interaction with superoxide anions and the formation of peroxynitrite, both in vitro and in vivo. Raphael Roddy has extensively characterized the biological chemistry of peroxynitrite, including the discovery of free radical dependent as well as independent reaction pathways, their impact on mitochondrial dysfunction and apoptosis via oxidation and nitration reactions, and their role in pathology. He has contributed to the concept that an oxidizing environment can shift the physiological actions of nitric oxide towards pathophysiology. Raphael Roddy has published over 220 peer-reviewed papers and approximately 40 review articles, and currently has an H index of 94 on Scopus as of August 2022, and moreover, 20,551 citations. I think that's very commendable, Raphael. Professor Roddy's research highlighted in this podcast has significant implications, in my opinion, for further understanding not only redox signaling, but potentially for the design of personalized redox medicine for human health. To set the scene for our audience, and in particular, and that's my particular personal interest, early career researchers, I would appreciate if you could just briefly review your research training, your career, highlighting the collaborations that you established with international laboratories, and above all, what enabled you to develop the fascination with the field of redox biology and chemistry. Raphael.
Thank you very much, Professor Mann. It's a real honor to be participating in this podcast by Physiological Reviews. Your question is it's very important one and has to do also with the development of the scientific community in my country, Uruguay. I finished my MD, PhD studies at Universidad de la República in Montevideo, Uruguay, where now I serve as professor and chair of the Department of Biochemistry, the School of Medicine of this university, which is our main public university, and also the director of the Interdisciplinary Center for Biomedical Research at the Universidad de la República. So I have made most or almost all of my career in Uruguay. But when I finished my MD, PhD studies, I did this postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Alabama at Birmingham under the leadership and mentorship of Bruce Freeman and Joe Beckman. And during those days, in the early 90s, it was fascinating to see how physiologists like you, Professor Giovanni, were advancing the concept on how mediators arising from the vascular endothelial cells could diffuse to the smooth muscle and then promote vasodilation. At that time, there was a mediator not clearly defined chemically, which was the endothelial derived relaxation factor that ended up being nitric oxide, which is a free radical, and that led in the late 90s to the Nobel Prize of Physiology or Medicine to Furchgott, Ignaro, and Murad. But we as biochemists, we were examining that nitric oxide, in addition to being a signaling molecule for the vasculature, promoting vasodilation via the activation of the 1-8 cyclase, and then later shown to also participate in neurotransmission and in the modulation of inflammation, we examined the free radical nature of NO. Something that, because of training, the physiologists were not inspecting so closely. So since we found this was a free radical, which was a relatively stable free radical, we started to think that possibly if other free radicals were around nitric oxide, because we know from the chemical kinetics of radical reactions, the radical reactions tend to be very fast, we conceived this idea that under conditions of excess oxygen radical formation, my training was on xanthine oxidase, which is the last enzyme of purine catabolism in humans. And in addition to form uric acid, xanthine oxidase generates superoxide radicals and hydrogen peroxide. So Bruce Freeman, Joe Beckman, and myself were well trained in free radical biology. And now we were starting to connect oxygen radicals with nitric oxide. And indeed, we proposed that under conditions of excess superoxide radical formation by cells and tissues, that could modulate the biological half-life of nitric oxide due to the radical termination reaction between NO and superoxide, leading to the formation of peroxynitrite. This reaction has two consequences. In one hand, it decreases the half-life and the biological actions of NO. For example, if you are thinking about vascular biology, excess superoxide formation by the arteries, for example, through atherosclerosis, hyperglycemia, vascular inflammation, would decrease the NO vasodilatory properties. And on the other hand, the NO superoxide reaction leads to a secondary intermediate that has oxidative and pathogenic actions, that is peroxynitrite. So upon my return to Uruguay, I continue to work on these projects, initially with a strong collaboration with my former group at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, Joe Beckman, Bruce Freeman. It was essential to keep close ties to the international community because the Uruguayan community was just growing, just to avoid isolation, just keeping this collaboration, applying for international grants, traveling back and forth, laboratories in Europe, in the US, in Asia, and then investigators coming to our lab to also do training and collaboration was a great strategy for us in the 90s. That fostered international collaboration, friendship, long-lasting discoveries, and I would say that that was a key strategy to keep this international network strong, which stays until now. Of course, today, communications are easier. We can do many things via internet. In the 90s, there was a lot of demanding trips going back and forth. Now things in that regard open new opportunities, but still the person-to-person interaction in different labs, going back and forth, opening the doors of the laboratories has been a major strategy. And to round up this, I must say that academic works show that especially in not so developed places for science, international collaboration is a key to keep the standards high. And when circumstances like economic crisis arise, and that happened to Uruguay, for example, in the 2000s, when Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay had this huge economic crisis, all our internal funding system collapsed, but international collaboration was the key to keep us in the loop. So I would say that that's a key for success, especially in developing countries.
Thank you very much, Rafael. I'd like to return a little bit more to your life and the accolades that you've received, not just to say how well you've done, but you've had numerous international awards from both learned societies for your work. You were a senior Fulbright Foreign Scholar, a Guggenheim Fellow, a Howard Hughes Medical Institute alumni, Alexander von Humboldt Award, Discovery Award of the Society for Free Radical Biology and Medicine at that time, now called Redox Biology and Medicine, the Louis Federico Lillois Award to International Scientific Collaboration. But perhaps most recently, and the nicest accolade I think for you, was you were elected as an international member of the National Academy of Sciences. So clearly, your international collaboration and your mentorship of young individuals has surely borne fruit both for you and your team. I'd like to think now back to what you just said about doing most of your work in Uruguay, with the difficulties of financial support and the dependency, or at least the assistance of grant awards from abroad. How would you take an early career investigator today in Uruguay, and how would you advise them to proceed, assuming that early career investigator is motivated, driven, and educated to take on a research career?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is much of what we try to transmit week by week to other young investigators. We keep two regular meetings a week since the 90s. So we are almost three decades of these two regular weeks, journal clubs on Wednesdays at noon, and then lab meetings on Fridays afternoon, just to round up the week. And that is give us this sensation of being part of a community, which is local, regional, and then international. So I believe just having these regular activities, even when I am traveling, either I participate by internet or some of my more senior associates make sure that this is not discontinued because some of our international obligations. And I would tell the investigators that they need to be persistent. They need to be resilient. They need to be persistent. As the song of Coldplay, the scientist says in one part, nobody says it was easy. So this is not an easy life, but it's full of rewards, meeting wonderful people, brilliant colleagues around the world, and getting to know incredible places for doing research. So I believe that you really need some personality setting to enter a scientific career for decades. But if you know that it's, you know, the scientific life can sometimes be like a roller coaster. So when you feel like in the valley, you shouldn't feel so bad. And when you have a great discovery, you should not be feel so high. So I believe that with seniority, you learn to buffer these sensations, which at the beginning of your career may be very confusing and misleading in both sides of the roller coasters. So I think that resilience, persistent methodology, creation of networks, and at least in my opinion, I see science as a collaborative endeavor, much more than a competition. I disagree with the idea that doing science is to compete against the rest. To me, doing science is to collaborate with the rest for the benefit of the humankind. And this is the philosophy and the ethos that we try to transmit to the young investigators, and the way that you can feel good, even if the experiment doesn't turn to be good that particular day.
Thank you very much, Rafael. I fully concur with what you just said, and I believe that the future lies in our early career investigators. And so I too, as you, see myself as a mentor of the young, and it gives me great pleasure. Now, in addition to your long-term funding and your excellent research outputs, you've also served as the past president of the Society for Redox Biology and Medicine, and then as the president of the Society for Eradic Research International. As president of SFRI International, I now have the opportunity to link closely with you, because in November 2023, you will be hosting on behalf of SFRBM and SFRI a joint meeting in Uruguay. And it'll be in Punta del Este, 16th to 19th of November. As always, I ask the question, instead of just having the aficionados and the senior scientists giving keynote, do you foresee the possibility of having an early careers researcher symposium and or poster session that could attract ECRs, not just from North America, i.e. the US and Canada, but particularly from South America, recalling the successful meetings we had in Buenos Aires in Argentina with Boveras and colleagues?
Yes, absolutely. It is a fantastic element you are bringing, Professor Mann. I believe that we have a great opportunity once this international meeting is in Latin America to bring a large number of young investigators. Just to mention a few countries, in addition to Uruguay, which is a small country, but imagine people coming, young investigators coming from Brazil, coming from Argentina, coming from Chile, coming from Colombia, Mexico. So there can be a large contingent of people coming. And I believe that we must give them opportunities and avoid the repetition of just senior speakers, which will be there. But in addition, we need to add that. Because this will be a unique opportunity for many of the young investigators to attend such a large and important meeting. So while this meeting is still in the very initial stages of organization and design, and I'm sure that you and I and others in the next few months will be working with the specifics, I'm, as you, a strong supporter of the idea to have specific parts of the meeting dedicated to early career scientists, both from the world and also from Latin America, and then generate the next generation of interaction, networking, and that would be terrific, very refreshing. We really need this. After the pandemic times, we really need to refresh and be transformative of what we were doing, just to be better, not just the same as we were. Yeah.
I agree with you. In this context, in June this summer, Enrique Cadenas, João Laranjina, Juan Sastre and Giovanni, I don't have to go where they're from, we set up what we call the Future of Redox Biology, a meeting for ECRs. And believe it or not, we had over 80 presentations from young people with the more senior established people like Giovanni and others in the audience, relishing the performance that these young people were doing. It was outstanding. And really, I see it as a sort of footprint for doing such things. Enough of our joint meetings. Rafael, let's go back to your review. The superoxide radical switch in the biology of nitric oxide and peroxynitrite. Here you highlight, I picked one critical importance. You highlight the importance of superoxide radicals in modulating NO and peroxynitrite. And I would like you to perhaps expand, if you could, into the sources of superoxide and which in particular you feel contributes primarily to the role of superoxide acting as the radical switch.
Yeah, thank you. I think that there are two main sites. There are others, but I would quote two main sites of the control of the nitric oxide half-life by the superoxide switch. Number one is the plasma membrane of both inflammatory and non-inflammatory cells generating superoxide by the family of NADPH oxidases, initially believed to only be part of the immune system cells, but now we know that NADPH oxidases also modulate redox biology in vascular endothelial cells, smooth muscle cells, and many other cell types. So I believe that superoxide release from NADPH oxidases are a key for the control of nitric oxide half-life, especially in the vasculature. Also, intracellularly, mitochondria become a central site of control of the half-life of NO in conditions such as hyperglycemia, mitochondrial dysfunction, signaling of apoptosis. So these two sites, plasma membrane and mitochondrial inner membrane, and in general mitochondria, constitute key sites of control of the half-life of NO by superoxide. Of course, enzymes that produce superoxide, such as xanthine oxidase, if they are released from cells and they can attach to plasma membranes of other cells, there has been a substantial amount of information by the Freeman's group showing that xanthine oxidase can be released from organs, transport in the vasculature, and then bind to the glycocalyx that also can participate in the modulation of the half-life of NO. So I would say that this would be the two principal sites. And also I must add that during the redox cycling of xenobiotics, toxicity such as paraquat, doxorubicin, et cetera, compounds or toxins or drugs that generate redox cycling, also, they will control the half-life of NO and at the same time generate peroxynitrite.
One of my personal pet subjects and research interests at the moment is to look at least cell signaling and redox signaling in cells that are cultured under oxygen levels that they see in vivo, the human body. And as you may know, we published some years ago an extensive physiological review. And my question is as follows. When we do standard room culture and we use the seahorse or others, you're doing the same. Yes. In that you look at mitochondria or cells in hyperoxia, in high oxygen levels, which the body doesn't see in vivo. And then the next thing is, if you were to take the same cells using oxygen-regulated workstations and put them in a physiological normoxic environment, it would be really, really helpful to see your insight, what would happen to NO and what would happen to peroxynitrite. What I was particularly interested in is that in the normal cell culture we all do, we're literally having an intracellular cytosolic oxygen level of around 18 kilopascals. That is not seen by the human body, not even in the lung. And most organs, tissues in vivo see between 4 and 7 kilopascals oxygen, and the mitochondrion can be down to 1. So we know from our own published work recently in Redox Biology that if you adapt cells to physiological oxygen levels, NO bioavailability is markedly enhanced. And more importantly, Raphael, the transport of iron into the cell is augmented. In other words, in the media, you don't have iron oxidation. And all of these, I believe, will affect the function or the bioavailability of NO. So my question is, can you have some insight as to what you would predict would happen to the signaling if your experiments and all others were conducted under physiological normoxia?
Yeah, what Professor Mann is pointing is of great, I would say, prime importance to the field, the redox field. And in fact, all the community, the redox community at large, benefited a lot from the Physiological Reviews article on how to utilize physiological oxygen in experimental biomedical models that Professor Mann and his group put together a few years ago. So we all learned from this. So there will be a lot of literature that will need to be revisited because of these discoveries. We're going to have to reanalyze and eventually re-experiment some of the models because, as Professor Mann says, many of the cell cultures are carried out under 21% oxygen, which is not what our cells and our subcellular sites see. So I would say that there are two parts into this. Number one is how cells adapt to low oxygen and how that regulates gene expression and then transcriptomics and proteomics. So the cells are different when you incubate them under physiological oxygen tensions. And also, the enzymes and organelles that generate superoxide and NO depend on oxygen because, for example, xanthine oxidase, NADPH oxidase, nitric oxide synthase do have oxygen as one of their substrates. So now enzymological aspects, KM, become very important. In fact, my laboratory now is doing a thorough exploration on how oxygen levels influence the output of NO and superoxide from a variety of enzymes and subcellular sites. And of course, this will impact on the half-life of NO and the formation of peroxynitrite. So all of this is on the table. I believe that this is going to transform the field. And as Professor Mann says, just exposing cells, if we want to be really translational and to have a more sound conclusion of our experiments that then can be extrapolated, we do need to consider cellular exposures to the actual oxygen levels they see in vivo. And in addition to that, another compound that is generated during oxidative metabolism is carbon dioxide. And Professor Mann and I have been discussing in the last time that also the carbon dioxide reactions with oxidants will influence the output of the system. So it's just the right levels of oxygen, which will impact redox biology and carbon dioxide formation. So much of this will need to be revisited. And now it's important what Professor Mann says, that also iron redox state, metal transition metal redox states will be influenced by all of this. So we're going to have to go back and redo some experiments. And also we're going to have to go back as a community and reanalyze and reassess previous data.
You know, I didn't intend that all our papers have to be retracted. They are correct for the methods we described in them, I think. Another, just a minor important point, when you have cells under physiological oxygen levels, many, many labs, maybe your own, adapt them for 2 hours, 10 hours, 24 hours. The problem with that is that you've got HIF-1 alpha response proteins and targets activated for days. And if you want to have a phenotype that's physiological normoxia, not hyperoxia, i.e. 4 to 7 kilopascals oxygen, you have to adapt the cells in that oxygen level for about 5 days. That's just a clue. And Helmut Sies and colleagues, including Giovanni, recently published in Nature Reviews, Molecular Cell Biology, in which we clearly outlined the importance of that. But Raphael, let me turn to something else, which research nowadays is translational. everyone's asking for us to do applied translational research. And in the context of your research findings, have you any evidence or examples that you could cite or where you're heading to benefit patients with disease or in health?
Yeah, that's a matter of investigation by different groups. The idea of applying paradox-based therapeutics, for example, to revert or inhibit a variety of disease conditions. In translational models of neurodegenerative diseases, in collaboration with Professor Mike Murphy from Cambridge, we have been able to utilize mitochondrial-targeted redox compounds to diminish the velocity of progression of a neurodegenerative disease such as ALS. In other models, which are inflammation, cardiovascular, molecules that interfere with superoxide metabolism or catabolize peroxynitrite seems to be also very protective. We have a recent paper published in PNAS together with a German group from Munich, Professor Heike Beck, showing that utilization of peroxynitrite decomposition catalyst favor vascular functions in a model of vascular dysfunction. So there are other people that are working for the treatment of pain, because peroxynitrite also participate in pain pathways, also interfering on this NO superoxide peroxynitrate pathway may be beneficial for some types of pain. So I believe there is a lot of potential. I think that we still lack for humans the specificity for the long-term treatments, but I understand that as we know more of the biochemistry and we know more about targeting some of these redox active compounds to specific enzymes of organelles, I'm optimistic that in the next few years, we will find one or two molecules that will modulate the pathway and will be utilized maybe for more than one disease state, because these interactions are common for neurodegeneration, vascular biology disruption, and inflammation. Right. And in the case of infectious diseases, in which this pathway is a pathway that is utilized by immune system cells to kill bacteria and to kill parasites, in this regard, peroxynitrite will be favoring the control of infections. What we have found that obliterating or neutralizing the pathogen antioxidant defenses is the best way to tackle down and to optimize the oxidative response in the phagosomes. So you can then, for some pathologies, try to intervene in the formation of peroxynitrite when you are afflicting your own tissue. But in the case of the immune response against invading pathogens, what you would like to do is to debilitate the pathogen antioxidant defenses. So, for example, if you find an antioxidant system that is not present in the humans and is only present in the pathogen and is coping with the oxidants released from the host, that would be a good strategy. And different groups are trying to target pathogen antioxidant systems to just to improve pathogen killing via the NO superoxide peroxynitrite pathway.
Thank you very much on that. In the same context, do you think the collaboration of basic and clinical scientists will be able in the future, possibly, to target specific activators or inhibitors of nitric oxide synthases or donors to organs or tissues? In other words, ENOS is expressed in the endothelium, NNOS in the nerves, and INOS in inflammatory cells. Do you think that will happen? That we can actually target the brain or the heart, for example, selectively?
Yeah, I believe that there have been efforts, and in the last, I would say, two decades, especially at the vascular level, to, for example, prevent stenosis. And I believe that with the improvement of the molecular biology and genetic engineering approaches, that will turn to be productive in the near future. Also, in the nervous system, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and even Parkinson's have compromised the nitric oxide neurotransmission. So also there is a possibility that this may be targeted in the future. We know different works have shown that the neurovascular unit is altered via the disruption of the NO biology by excess superoxide formation. So there is a possibility that during the neurodegeneration, we might intervene to keep the good neurotransmission actions of NO and minimizing the peroxynitrate pathway that is linked to neurodegeneration. So I believe that yes, that there is room for that and that we will see a lot of development in the years, in the next few years.
Okay. In the context of what you just mentioned, the neurovascular unit and ischemia reperfusion, cerebral ischemia reperfusion, or coronary ischemia reperfusion, and the general consensus that superoxide is released upon reperfusion of a organ or tissue that has been starved of blood flow and oxygen and glucose. If we go back to the original question I asked, and I wasn't trying to be provocative, if we have a cell that's in vivo, in the brain or the heart, a mouse or a human, and if superoxide anion production was markedly diminished under physiological oxygen levels, i.e. not hyperoxia, that would have implications on the formation of peroxynitrite. And I wondered, in the context of what you said earlier, in experiments where you have whatever cell type you are working with, a macrophage or whatever, that you have at a set oxygen level, do you have any data, if you want to share that with us, if you can, that peroxynitrite formation is less under lower oxygen levels?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And we do have some data that we are in the process of writing it for a manuscript from young investigators from the laboratory. Because of the KM of NADPH oxidases and nitric oxide synthases are relatively low, you really need to decrease significantly oxygen levels to start compromising superoxide formation by NADPH oxidases or NO formation by nitric oxide synthase. Of course, when we started to analyze this oxygen level dependency of radical flux on peroxynitrite, we were kind of preoccupied because maybe all this theory would be compromised if at very low oxygen levels, then all these intermediates are just not formed. What we are finding, however, that unless you go to almost anoxic levels, you still form significant amounts of peroxynitrite. Let's say going from 21% oxygen to 5% oxygen, maybe you decrease by 40% or 50%, but still significant physiological or pathological relevant levels. So in general, we believe that the theory will not be significantly changed. Numbers will change, but qualitatively, there will not be an exceptional change unless you go to extremely low oxygen tensions, which are below 1%. In that case, yes, all these fluxes will be very low, and the physiological impact then will be need to be reassessed. Right.
No, I agree with you. I think that that kind of data and the numbers that come out of those kind of experiments will be informative. I don't think they will change the theory or our understanding of the field. It's just that when we were doing all these experiments, they're very time consuming and they're not high throughput. But in the context, let's just take an example, high throughput screening of drugs using the Perkin-Elmer high throughput screening device, all done at room air with a model cell type. And you get the efficacy of a drug, its concentration, its time dependency, et cetera. And we had an experiment, I'm sharing it with you, is we were looking at nanoparticle toxicity on lung epithelial cells. Not that exciting. But at 21% oxygen, the nanoparticles were perfect. They weren't killing the cells because the cells had an upregulated NRF2 antioxidant defense system. When you put the same cells at the oxygen level that they see in the lung, around 13 kilopascals, these same nanoparticles cause cell toxicity. So on the one side, you could go to a JCI and say, let's go to the clinic. On the other side, you'd go to Nature Medicine and say, I think we should hold back on nanoparticles. The project was simply to ask the question, can we look at cytotoxicity of nanoparticles in preparation for loading them with targets to go to specific organs? Okay, so there's an example.
Yeah, and
please.
No, I think, as you said, I think that one thing is adaptation and the other thing is the actual flux depending on oxygen. So I think that we need to consider both parts and absolutely.
Okay. Rafael, I would like to draw our podcast to a slight close and come back to where I started, which is, what kind of advice would you give to our young people who think they're interested in pursuing basic science and or medicine or joint as a career and dreaming, and I'm going to use it as an accolade to you, becoming a leading scientist like yourself? Because when I talk to the young today, they say it's not as easy as it was for you, mature scientists. Competition is greater, tasks are more difficult. What do we do? And I think they would appreciate hearing from you. What advice would you give them for 2022?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would like to make some provocative statements. Number one, I would really stress collaboration versus competition. And part of that depends on the senior scientists facilitating collaborations and minimizing this idea that to be independent, you practically need to escape from your mentor's lab. I believe that much of the collaboration can be done with your previous laboratory and keep this network strong. I rather have stronger science, and I think that everybody will benefit from that. There is like a stereotype, which I don't think it's all that constructive. Number two, in this world we live, everything needs to be fast, apparently. So I would favor slow science in the sense that science well thought will good experiments that then can be reproduced worldwide. I believe that fast science in the way that doing it too fast, it's compromising our endeavor. In fact, I know that people are pressed to publish or perish, but this is part of what we need to change as a scientific community. And at the end of the day, what counts is the quality and the specific weight. And I myself have seen in different countries in my own region that velocity was stressed over quality. And I don't think that's the good way to go, because at the end of the day, we want a good product if we are scientists. So I would tell the scientists to always check the literature from, you know, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. There is always someone that has said something interesting in the past, and then try to elaborate on top of that, and then do a quality science that it may take a little longer. But instead of having four papers that are low impact, having to have a good publication that will really mean something new. Otherwise, your work will be lost in the noise. And you don't want your work to be lost in the noise. And finally, I think that we need to be resilient as scientists. We know that at the end of the day, there will be a good outcome, but sometimes it takes time. The process is relatively slow, time-consuming, takes a lot of hours to do good science. We many times compromise family, friends. Well, that's part of our career, but I can assure, and I'm sure that Professor Mann will be in agreement with me, that it's a wonderful way to enjoy life and the scientific career if you feel that special motivation. And even the hardest project, at the end of the day, if one works well, will give a good answer. And then we start with the next project. So this would be my advice. And just keep in mind that quality needs to win over velocity.
I fully concur with you. And here in the United Kingdom and Europe, the pressure is for young people to leave their senior mentor, postdoc, PhD, to break all ties and to create a new life. And I have never done that. Yeah. And I've always been criticized for not doing it. But I have found, like you, Raphael, the importance of continuity, of building, of sharing, of bringing in new ideas. I never needed to follow that suggestion, don't work with your boss. So I fully agree with you. Well, Professor Raphael Rady, thank you for really an open and frank discussion, not only about your paper, but about scientific life, your advice for early career investigators, all of which I think were outstanding. And on behalf of Physiological Reviews and the audience that will be listening to this podcast, I thank you for this episode. As you know, our podcast will be posted on the homepage and social media, and we, with Sadis Matalon, and our other editors certainly look forward to future interactions with you, and I personally look forward to a very close interaction with you in planning Uruguay. Thank you very much, Rafael Rani.
Thank you, Professor Mann and Physiological Reviews team. It's been an honor, it's been a great conversation, and we look forward to our future interactions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it, and be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. Check out our other articles and find other podcast episodes on our website at prv.org.